Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Okay. Hey, this is Sam.
Hi, Sam. All right, we're gonna take a roll here shortly. So thank you all for coming to our first meeting of the year. We are going to call the meeting to order. And then Jax is going to do roll call for us.
Member Burns? Member Karen?
Yeah, I'm on.
Great. Member Dye? Member Feimuller?
Here.
Member Gallifin?
Present.
Member Kaufman?
Present.
Member Kelly? Member Loftus?
Yep.
Member Mayer? Member McLaughlin? Chair Mussey?
Here.
Member Patel?
Present.
Member Pulakot? Vice Chair Sklamberg? Member Van Boeing?
This is just Dr. Scott. I'm here in Van Boeing's.
Thank you. Thank you. Member Van Howling?
Present.
Member Borelli? Member Wise? I got you, Member Borelli. My apologies. We do have quorum.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, if I could, too. Historically, we've had an Ellis Air Force Base as part of the membership, too, and I was talking to the chair. We've got a new hospital commander, Ryan Mahata. And so I'm not sure if I'll provide his email address, but he's new to the community, and obviously the VA and Nellis Air Force is a part of our community. If you don't mind, we'll ensure that they're here at the next meeting.
Yes, sir.
I'll provide
definitely that for you.
Okay. All right, well, next we are going to open up for the public session. If anyone would like to give a public comment, comments will be limited to 5 minutes per speaker. Or anyone that would like to do a public comment?
No public comments online, ma'am.
All right. Next, we need a motion and approval for the adoption of the May 2nd, 2023 agenda.
Motion to approve the minutes from the May.
May 2nd, 2023,
please.
Second?
I'll second.
All right, second.
Liz?
And then we had a consent agenda for our last meeting, so we need a motion to approve the minutes from the Facility Board Advisory Board meeting from October 25th, 2022, which was a long time ago. But we can get a motion and approval for that.
Motion to approve. Second.
I'm kicking them under the table. All right. Well, next we are going to have some report and discussion. We have a couple of different presentations that we're going to share today. The first is receive and discuss initiatives to identify areas that need to be improved or topics hospitals would like to discuss further, such as logistical barriers. And Sarah Lugo from the Southern Nevada Health District. We are going to invite you up for your presentation.
Good evening, everybody. Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us to speak today. So I just want to first introduce myself. My name is Dr. Cortland Lopez Cervas, the Chief Medical Officer for the Health District. Sarah Lugo, who's one of our nursing supervisors, is going to do a presentation. I just wanted to introduce her in the topic. So just very, very briefly, in regards to this issue has to do with the COVID vaccination. Of course, in the last couple of years, the Health District, along with as many partners, have been providing COVID vaccination to our members of our community through both fixed and pop-up sites. Our goal, though long-term, is to try to get the vaccines into provider offices, hospitals, urgent care centers, and the like, to try to, so as we have a sustainable plan to be able to continue to provide the vaccine, especially once our COVID vaccine ends in 2024. So with that, I'm going to have Sarah Lugo come up and give a presentation, and I'll be available for questions afterwards as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here. Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. Everyone can hear me okay. My name is Sarah Lugo. I am the COVID-19 vaccine supervisor here at Southern Nevada Health District. I have been doing this since COVID started. I may have worked with you directly or worked with your emergency managers or your pharmacists or your infection control nurses in your hospitals over the past couple years. I've been doing immunizations for over a decade. I've also been a med surgeon or on the floor in the hospitals as well. But enough about me. So I am going to briefly talk to you guys about the current status of COVID-19 vaccines in Clark County. I also want to discuss about the hospital involvement. We're not asking for you to be a shot clinic, but there are a couple ways that we are asking for consideration for a COVID-19 vaccine to come into the hospitals. And then also to inform you that COVID-19 vaccine is not the same vaccine it was. It has gotten easier. So if you haven't heard on the news, storage and handling has gotten easier, schedules have gotten easier, and ordering has gotten easier. So if you look here, if you guys remember back in December 2020 when we first started in the hospitals providing vaccine, over the first year, you can see on that first set of numbers for March 29, 2022, with a collaboration of this whole entire county between the hospitals, the pharmacists, the mass pods, the community partners, there were over 3 million vaccines that were given here in Clark County alone. Over the next year, to bring us up to March 24th, 2023, this year, we've given over 4 million vaccines in that collaboration with all of those partners here in Clark County alone. It's a lot. We've done well. So you can see here, though, where we fall off is for dose two. If you look at that second column there under 2023, is where we were doing pretty well for dose two. The follow-up doses came, but then when we got to the bivalent doses, you can see an immediate drop. So after September 1st, there was a bivalent dose that came out for the most updated vaccine. And you can see a large drop from there. What the studies are showing is with the monovalent primary series, the effectiveness of them are about 25% for those that have received those. And for a bivalent vaccine, it's about 60%. So it's quite a big jump. So it is very important to have that bivalent vaccine. And in a moment, we'll have a PowerPoint to go with it, too. Those that do have it there, you can see that for that bivalent dose, there's only about 25% of our population that are over the age of 50 on that bottom chart there. There's only about 26% that have received that bivalent dose, and knowing that 65 and up are our highest risk for the COVID-19 with hospitalizations and deaths, you can see that we have quite a gap of those for coverage and protection for COVID-19 vaccine. So a little background about this is that the emergency departments we know act as about 1/5 of the U.S. population for access points to care. We also know that the urgent cares handle about 29% of primary care visits, and that CDC recommends that vaccines, COVID vaccine, be provided for patients that are in the hospital at discharge who are not moderately or severely ill. The reason why I come to you today is because of the next two points that are on here. And that is that many skilled nursing facilities and long-term care facilities or smaller residential care homes require COVID-19 vaccine for admission. And then also that hospitals can currently offer, many hospitals also offer vaccines at discharge. So flu vaccine, pneumonia vaccine is often a standing protocol at discharge. So we have a small ask, and this is coming up because we've had this come up issue. So my particular program for the COVID-19 vaccine program is anything pretty much that's COVID vaccine related that happens outside of the health district building. So we launch the strategies and the initiatives for the state. We act as a redistribution center. We do the outreach. We look at these high-risk populations, and we create clinics or pop-ups or ways that we can get to these high-risk populations.
One of the things that has come up is we've had hospitals call us that have needed COVID vaccine because they're having a delay in transfer for their patients who cannot get accepted into certain care homes because they need a COVID-19 vaccine and they're not carrying it into the hospital. And so it's causing a delay, especially if it's on a weekend or if we're not, or if they need us to bring them vaccine. But with that being said, we also run a homebound program and a long-term care facilities program as well, also launching these initiatives too. So one of the things, for instance, that we have had happen, and this kind of goes along with some other stories along with it, probably one of the more recent ones is we did have a patient. We were going to go do a homebound visit on them to give them vaccine. They ended up getting sick before we were able to get out there. They were hospitalized. The wife called us from the hospital saying they can't get discharged into where they want to go because they aren't COVID. We got hospitalized instead of getting vaccinated. And the patient ended up having to go to one care home so we could use the homebound program to go vaccinate them so that they could move into the actual care home that they were going to go. So we did want to just bring this up, make sure that it was on your radar. One of the things that we do as a redistribution center is we're able to bring you a small lot of vaccine to carry in your pharmacies just to hold on hand for any of these instances that may come up. And so we wanted to make sure that you are aware of that in case these do create, so there's not a delay in discharge for these patients. Another thing we want to do is consider that if your hospital does provide flu or pneumonia or has standing orders for vaccine for patients that are discharged, it's not that it's getting easier to give COVID vaccine if you would consider adding the COVID-19 vaccine to your list if you are already providing those. If you're providing vaccine in your hospital, you're set up to provide COVID-19 vaccine as well as far as storage and handling goes. That's really bright on this screen, but I'm gonna talk you through it. So over the past 2 weeks, and if you have listened to any of the ACIP meetings, you know, we pop popcorn and we're excited about those votes when they come through on there. But they are really working to make it an easier schedule that people can follow. So I specifically focus on 12 years and up, knowing that you would be more focused on the adults. But for 12 years and old, up that are without immunocompromise, in a nutshell, if they are unvaccinated or they've never gotten a bivalent dose, they're gonna get one bivalent dose and they're gonna, that's the schedule, okay? If they are older than 12 years old and they have gotten one bivalent dose, if they're between 12 and 64, normal adult age, they're done. They don't need any more, okay? If they're over the age of 65, they have the option, they can get another bivalent dose, okay, which would maybe quite a bit of your patients there. All right, so we want to make sure that's available, especially if you saw the numbers earlier, where we're looking at 50 plus with only a 25% completion rate of the bivalent doses. Now, the immunocompromised, this does change a little bit, because of course that is who we are seeing in the hospitals. It's also who we're seeing with the highest complications of COVID-19 vaccine. I will tell you, hot off the press, at 11:30 last night, CDC did roll out their new recommendations for immunocompromised, again, trying to make that easier. In a nutshell, this was made about a week ago, so it does say 6. Last night it did come out with 12 and up. But in a nutshell, if there's no history of bivalent dose, you're gonna give them a bivalent dose. They're immunocompromised. If they are immunocompromised, they do have a bivalent dose history, then it's optional and they can get a bivalent dose. And if the provider would like to give them another one, they are able to get another one. So for hospital purposes, if they're immunocompromised, then they can receive another bivalent dose if they have that immunocompromise on there. Storage and handling. Long are the days gone where we needed an ultra-cold freezer. You don't need an ultra-cold anymore. If you hold vaccine and if you have a delivery hospital or delivery section in there, they do hold the vaccine. They offer, because all babies that are born get a hepatitis B vaccine. You do have the equipment that you need to hold a COVID-19 vaccine. Vaccine is held at 2 to 8 degrees, just like all others. And you can see that Pfizer will store for 10 weeks in the fridge and Moderna will store for 30 days. Now, if you look at enrollment and ordering, all of our hospitals here in Clark County are enrolled in the Clark County, in the Nevada State Immunization Program for COVID-19. They're already enrolled. You don't have to worry about that. That happened back in December 2020. We're just asking people to carry it in the hospitals. There is a decreased minimum order, so if your pharmacy would prefer to order it directly, they absolutely can and have it shipped directly to the pharmacy. However, if they'd like to order those smaller lots, we are more than happy to bring that from our redistribution center that's here at this main office here, and we can bring it to your pharmacy, and we do it all the time if we have it. We have certain hospitals that we do work with, and they call us, and we'll bring it and make sure they have it over the weekend. We find that Fridays seem to be a big discharge day, so Thursday seems to be a redistribution day we are happy to do that. Now, one of the things that we do have on there is single-dose syringes. We do have a limited supply of these, so single-dose syringes are provided as well, as long as we have the supply. We are holding them for hospitals specifically that can hold those in the pharmacy. There's also the avoiding missed opportunities. So I did take this right off of the CDC website. There was some concerns that we had heard about wastage of vaccine, if they were only going to open one dose and not have to give any more. So I want to just make sure I got this straight off the CDC website, because they drilled this in us, is that they are not worried about those doses. They are more worried about the missed opportunities. So for a Pfizer, it has 6 doses. Moderna has 5 doses. What they've said, and we've been doing this for over a year, is that if you have 1 or 2 patients that need that dose, it's better to give them the dose than to miss that opportunity and get in just because you're worried about wasting those other doses. They would rather them be protected. The CDC has also provided these great tools to make that. If you don't already have a standing order, they have standing orders already made. This will need a little tweaking here. We are more than happy to help with that as well with the new recommendation on here. They also have the pre-checklist, which is the vaccine administration record that's required for all vaccines. So they do provide that as well. So there's no guesswork for your team while they're making up the protocols or procedures that you may need as assistance for them there. And as I said, we're more than happy to assist as well. For billing, you can bill for the administration of COVID vaccines. So here, American Medical Association has a great access tool for your billing department where they can access the NDC numbers and then also the CPT numbers that they may need for billing as well. All right, so I have a wonderful healthcare provider team. This is an initiative that we've launched here at Clark County. And we do have quite a few providers that are enrolled in the COVID vaccine here in Clark County. We have about 250. However, there's only about 44 providers that actually carry vaccine in the office. So this is a big initiative that we're launching, that providers will recommend the vaccine and that they'll actually get it in the office, knowing that inconvenience is one of the biggest barriers for adults to receive vaccine. So I'm going to introduce my two colleagues. This is Markia and Michelle. They are our healthcare provider initiative team, and they are more than happy. They go out, they do trainings, they will work with your pharmacist. Your pharmacist can contact them directly, or your infection control nurse, whoever you have in charge of the vaccine. They can reach out to them directly and they'll get them whatever they may need. So, and that includes if they need more, if you need training on the floor, maybe like a little 5-minute huddle with your nurses before shift, they're more than happy to come out and train as well. Our job is to figure out how do we make it easy for you, and what are the barriers that you're running into or challenges, and how do we overcome them. So we'll have their cards right over on the table here. If you'd like to pick those up and pass them along to anyone you think that may be interested or that may be involved in this, then we're more than happy to have them reach out directly, try and cut out as many middlemen as we can, and make that an easy process for you. So that is all I had. Is there any questions for me?
Yeah, I have a question. Thank you for presenting. I know when we have talked about it as hospital CEOs in the past, there was concern about storage and then, you know, just not being vaccine clinics. The Moderna does only last 30 days, right? And so we can have one patient that needs it every 30 days. And so do the patients still have to receive the like vaccines?
Good question. So this actually just came out around 11:30 last night with the immunocompromised. If they're not immunocompromised, they can get any mRNA vaccine. Doesn't matter. If they are immunocompromised and it's starting as those primary series, then it depends where they are in the history, then they have to get the like vaccine on there. But again, it is 5 doses of the Moderna now, so if you're needing multiple vials, we could make a hospital deliver you to you every week if you wanted to give you those smaller amounts of vials for Moderna.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then has the tracking improved? Because it was pretty cumbersome. I mean, we had to have a full-time person just just entering into the database.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing up. That's kind of where we're like trying to figure out how do we make that easier. So I think if the tracking is the issue, that's where we want to get involved and figure out, okay, is that a portion that we can do for you? Is that a way that we can work with the state to streamline that? Is there a way that if that's the holdup and that's the barrier, then that's where we need to figure out a solution to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, those are my thoughts. I don't know if it's up to my colleagues and colleagues on the phone too.
So I think, again, some of that tracking, I mean, there's patients that don't know their medications when they're in the hospital at all. The family members don't know it. So have they been vaccinated at all? Have they had their booster and all that? So the resources to go into the database, perhaps, and try to have to check that puts a burden on the pharmacy. And then just there was some concern that patients in the hospital, obviously very sick in this day and age, when they go home, they may not be 100%. So a lot of people get put down with that vaccine for a few days. So readmissions are a big concern of hospitals. We have a lot of accountability to CMS. And so when a patient gets readmitted, that creates some issues for the facilities, regulatory and financial, through the Medicare program and other programs. So if someone goes home and feels really sick, complements on top of that other illness they had, are they going to be coming back?
Understood. Thank you, and thank you for bringing that. Those are definitely things that we will bring back to the state as well. When we're talking about what are hesitancies on carrying in the hospital as far as discharge on there. I know the North is carrying it every now, and they're doing it normally on discharge. And if that's something reluctant to do right now, then at least maybe carry a couple doses for any of those that may need to get needed as they're being discharged to another facility. Why we work out those kinks, and I appreciate you bringing this up.
Do you know about how many Renown does a week?
I don't. I can find out for you. Generally, all hospitals have the Nevada Immunization Access to Nevada Immunization Web IZ record, so it would be a matter of pulling it up to see if they would qualify for that vaccine, which is the beauty of Nevada, that you don't have to carry around those cards all the time. I know we do have that record in there.
So part of that, like right now, at my hospital, Southern Hills, my ID nurses are the ones that have access to that and enter that. But on nights, on weekends, you know, they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And so how would we go about, you know, accessing the database? Because wouldn't we want to do that first before we administer the vaccine?
You do want to do that first, yeah. Now I know a lot of the EMRs, depending on what the EMR is, it will automatically roll over into the Nevada WebIZ. For instance, like your babies, a lot of those get automatically rolled into the WebIZ, but it's looking it up. As you're mentioning there, it would be a matter of going in and looking it up in Nevada WebIZ to find that record on there. And that, you know what, maybe one of the things is offering it for those that may have their record or may know what their immunization status is. You know, a lot of the guys do carry those cards in their wallets, especially our older clientele on there. They often do have those cards in there that they can do. But yes, best practice would be to look it up in Nevada WebIZ and see what is the most up-to-date schedule on there.
Maybe this is naive, but you know, the ask is being asked of us to do it before discharge. Has there ever been an ask on the SNFs and other to have it upon admission? To put it there, they're so concerned about it. Why don't we just put it there and then give it to the patient upon admission?
That's great. Yes, we are launching a program exactly for that as well, and trying to hit all areas on both sides. Yeah.
And the SNFs been receptive?
It is for hospitals, healthcare bearers, and long-term care providers. We are working diligently to try and have people carry it in their office to offer it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there any feedback on the line? I know Vince was on there.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Member Burns just joined, and so did Dr. Legan as well.
Okay. Great. Vince, Sam, any thoughts? Or any of the other facility CEOs?
Well, I'll be honest with some of the population that we deal with, as stated earlier, it would be very hard determine who's vaccinated, who's not. That's my only concern. Protocol at the hospital, especially the demographics I cater to in my facility. Just getting an idea to this question for our times. So that's my only hesitation with this.
And now the health district is going to stop providing it, but the pharmacies are going to continue?
The health district will actually continue.
Okay.
Providing COVID vaccine, you may see those in different lights as far as offering a lot more general population, maybe more to more specific populations. We will always have it available to general public on there as well. I think the biggest barriers for adults is convenience, access, and then costs are always the biggest barriers for any type of vaccine. So our goal is to always try and overcome those to increase the uptake of them.
So what is the cost for the patients if they get it done in the hospital?
So as far as the hospital cost itself, right now vaccine is free. So we can come and bring you vaccine, especially for those that are being discharged to the long-term care facilities. But however, we do hear that commercialization will be occurring. We're not quite sure when or what that will bring. But for now, the vaccine is free itself. And then you can get reimbursed for the administration fee.
Any other questions, comments, concerns?
I'm here primarily from the EMS side, but as an ER doc, I can tell you that the WebIZ, you don't, as a patient, you can log in without previous access and just check your record. So some of our patients that do have access to this part, like, hey, can you check your information?
Yeah.
And you can pull up your records. So it is possible to do without a login.
No, I think that maybe we can take, if you can share your presentation, we can send it out to all the facilities. I'm happy to send it out and get feedback from anyone. I know that during the pandemic, we had hesitation. It was mostly storage, the 30-day time frame, but with some of the changes, you know, maybe they our colleagues would be more open to it.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for your consideration. On that PowerPoint, just have Marquis and Michelle's direct contact on there that they can reach out to so that we can bring vaccine over. And we do have that limited supply of those single dose syringes that we're more than happy to share.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Sklenberg just joined as well.
All right, thank you. Hello, Vice Chair Sklenberg.
Yeah, hi there.
All right, well, next we are going to have a presentation from Deborah Moran from the Southern Nevada Medical Reserve Corps.
Fidel, are we running that from the PDF or is it on the PowerPoint? Because I don't think I can flip through the PDF. I'm Deborah Moran. I've been here at the health district for about 16 years. I'm in the Office of Public Health Preparedness. Some of you may be familiar with the Office of Public Health Preparedness. You might even know my boss, Jeff Quinn. So my part at the OPHP is to run the Medical Reserve Corps, which is a volunteer program. And so today, I want to talk to you a little bit about volunteering in general, about what the Medical Reserve Corps is, and then how I could possibly help you in your facilities, and then how how I implement my volunteers on a regular basis, and maybe we can work together to try and get a plan going. So Does anybody here volunteer? Like, do you have volunteer stuff? You know, you go and spend some time doing pro bono and stuff. I get a lot of questions. People say, well, why do people volunteer? Why do they volunteer? You know, my volunteers, they usually want to make a difference and they want to do something for a cause. So they want to do something that's worthwhile. Sometimes they just want to practice their skills. They're nurses and they haven't been, you know, picking up their blood pressure cuff and stuff. So they want to go out and do some volunteer work, maybe get some shots or something. Sometimes I get students that want to just get hours in volunteering for summer credits. And some people are just, they're retired people and they just want to get out of the house because they're bored and they want to go, you know, be active in the community. So my volunteers, I have a wide range of volunteers, but we have medical professionals, everything from physicians, practitioners, paramedics, we have lab workers and technicians. Some of them are students. They might be public health students. They might be nursing students. I got a bunch of those. In fact, it's kind of nice. Sometimes I see them when they first start school, and then I get to see them graduate. They're like my little ducks, you know? Get to watch them grow up. Sometimes they're retirees that have lots and lots of experience. So, you know, they have a big value. All my volunteers are 18 and older. I don't have any that are high school students or anything like that. The Medical Reserve Corps, I don't know if anybody, is anybody familiar with the Medical Reserve Corps? Got one? All right. It's across the entire country. It's in the territory. So there's right now, the latest I pulled is 754 units. It's like the best kept secret in the country because no one's ever heard of them, but they're everywhere. Here in Nevada, we have three units. We have our unit here, Medical Reserve Corps, Southern Nevada, and then we have Washoe County and then Western Nevada, which is up in Carson City. And all of us are active. We're all under the CERB-NV system. So that is the state website. And you may have heard of Battleborn Medical Corps. And before that, we had the statewide volunteer pool, and that kind of merged into the Battleborn Medical Corps that was created when the pandemic started. And we're all kind of managed under the same umbrella. There's other organizations that are also on CERB-NV, but that is like the main point for volunteers to sign up and for us to manage them from that database. So I have about 395 volunteers right now. They come and they go, you know. I get new ones all the time, and sometimes people move or they retire or whatever, and they don't want to volunteer anymore. Like I said, it's a wide range of volunteers. Some volunteers are not even medical people at all, but they're very, as you well know, you have one medical person in a clinic, you need a lot of non-medical people to get them through. You need clerks. You need people to put line control, to get people funneled into where they need to be, especially in an emergency. You need those people to be door screeners, to maybe help interpret if they're bilingual, things like that. When I sign up my volunteers, there's a process. There's things that I do. There's things a volunteer does, including it starts all on the CERB-NV website. I do have my volunteers. They are required to complete the ICS 100 and 700 courses so that they have some kind of idea about emergency management. We had a lot of volunteers that when we dropped that requirement for the pandemic, but now I reinstituted it, so we're working toward compliance to get them all for our federal funding to have them all trained on ICS courses. I do verify their credentials. If they tell me they're a nurse, I go look it up. I don't take their word for it. I make sure that they have a valid license that's unencumbered, that nothing is wrong with their license. They do a state background check. It's just a basic background check done through the state CERB-NV system. I add them to all my contact info. We even have an emergency notification system so that we can send out phone calls in an emergency to tell people, hey, something's going on. You know, like on October 1, something's going on. We're gonna need people. Watch your email for details. And then they can go and see, you know, what I send in the email. We do issue them a badge similar to our employee badges, but they're a little different color. But of course, we ask them to have their own ID in addition to that. This is not like an ID, we tell them. But it is something that at least shows you that, yes, they did come from me. Plus, with me, I will send you a list of who's coming. So you'll know who's supposed to be there and who's not. You won't just get random people showing up and saying they're volunteers. So we do also offer other training, and we suggest other training for our volunteers. So this is stuff that they may or may not have. So we might be able to pull, if you need some volunteers to help that have been trained in psychological first aid or CPR, if we want people that have valid CPR cards, if you want people that are trained in suicide prevention or something, we could search my database for those things. And we do give these kinds of trainings periodically here at the Health District, and we also send them out, because there's a lot of these that are available online too. We did a psych first aid in person, which that's the best way to take it, is in person. But it is also available on the NCTSN website for those that can't make it in person. So we do offer, let's stop working, there we go. So some of the past things that we've done, in the pandemic, we had volunteers going to give patient care at the isolation quarantine unit, and of course vaccinators and testers. And at the monoclonal antibody clinic, we had some volunteers go there. We had them help with auditing records and making sure that they're correct. That's another use for a non-medical volunteer, to help with your data entry or that kind of thing. Door screeners, call centers, things like that. Office help, those are all things that are good places to put volunteers. In fiscal years 2021 and 22, our volunteers contributed over $400,000 in service, almost entirely in COVID activities. So it's something that, you know, it does, you can see the value in having those volunteers come in for those jobs that are not, you can't fill them right away. You know, we can ramp them up with volunteers and then hire your staff to fill those extra jobs. What I wanted to talk to you about is that between the hospitals and my volunteer program, we currently don't have any kind of written plans. Last year in January, there was that bad surge, and everybody needed staffing, and you needed people to come and help, but we didn't have a plan in place to do that. And I would like to build some kind of relationship with your facility so that we can work on having some kind of process, so that when you say you need help, we already know, you know who I am, I know who your people are, I know where to send the people, what kind of training you're going to need, the 5 W's and an H, like the who, what, when, where, why, how it's going to go forward. I would really like it if we don't have to go through January of last year again, because that was challenging, I think, for everybody. It would be fantastic to try and work out some kind of plan. It's not unheard of that MRC units across the country have MOUs or letters of agreement with their hospitals so that they have a process to get volunteers in there. In the first, the first few days of an emergency, you can get them in there and then work on your credentialing and everything during that time. But if we never talk about it, then we're going to be in the same thing that happened last year, and I don't think any of us want to do that again. Volunteers, they're not a replacement for your paid staff, and I think that it's really important to stress that, and also that they're there temporarily to help when there's a crisis, when there's something that you can't possibly get staff in there. So the volunteers are like, auxiliary coming in. But the paid staff also need to be aware so that they don't feel threatened, that the volunteers are temporarily there They're there to help them. They're there to assist the staff. I mean, that's what a lot, the volunteers I was able to deploy to the hospitals, a lot of what they did was just help who's already there. You know, if they can help out, even one volunteer even was working in OBGYN because it freed up somebody so that they could go to a place that had higher demand. Again, some of the good places to put volunteers, wellness checks, you know, just taking vital signs, things that you don't have to have a login to get in the computer system. Office help, doing sorting, filing, copying, things like that. If you have a call center and you have to take calls and give information, that's another thing. You got that script, you know, give it to a volunteer to sit there and take calls. Things that you can describe easily or have just-in-time training are ideal. Or we can work together. If you have a set of training that you need done for people that come in, then let's work on it and get that list of what needs to be done so then I can build a cadre of people that have those credentials. So the people that have that training that you want or have signed those forms that you want. And then we can build that list of people so then they're ready to go. Let's see. Yeah, some of the requirements like access and badging, you know, that's something that we would probably need to work on is how do people come in and how do you identify them? If you have release forms to sign, you know, send them on over. I'll have them sign it. So these are some of the things that we've had to really work on, I think, is, you know, who do they report to? Where do they come in? You know, as being a 24-hour facility, there's probably multiple people, but there's probably one job position, you know, the manager of whatever shift it is. What's the thing about volunteers to remember, too, is that some of them will recur, they'll come back, but some of them might just come for a shift, and then they might not want to come back. But if you give them lots of smiles and thank yous, they'll probably come back. Again, this is kind of repetitive. There's the 5 W's and an H is what we have to work on. And PPE, that's another thing, is what kind of PPE is needed for whichever job it is, and who's going to supply it? Is it something that I do or you do? Do they need fit testing? Do I do it or do you do it? That kind of thing. As much notice as possible is good. Planning ahead is great. But I know you would need it in an emergency, so it'd be good to just have a template to go forward with. When I get an emergency deployment, I contact them through the ServeMD system, and I can send them an email. I can use the call down system to alert them. I can get some really quick responses from people. But I would need to know where to send them and who I'm sending and those kind of details first. On the back end of that, I have to follow up with time reporting because I report not just to the Board of Health, but also to the National Program Office. So, and that of course goes up to Congress and everything for funding for public health. So on the back end, I would need to have like a sign-in sheet or something like that. If you can give them coffee or a lunch card for their shift, great. If you can't, that's great too. Smiles and thank yous are pretty much what they work for. As I was just saying, we report to Congress. And just remember, they're not being paid, so they just want to make a difference. Telling them, you know, how they're making a difference or telling me how they can help make a difference is good. And a thank you and a smile is good. And of course, I like feedback. So I like you guys to tell me how they're doing, and I ask the volunteers how they like the assignment. You know, it's two-way street. There's my contact information. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Deborah. I think this is really helpful. I know that there was a lot of confusion in the pandemic of how to request and get the volunteers. And so we can certainly share this with the hospitals and with all our colleagues. Is this only for crisis situations, or is it?
Our volunteer program, we do have engagement all year round with the volunteers. because, you know, if you just put people on a list and you don't utilize them for anything, then, you know, that's not a good program. So we do utilize them for training and then for things around the health district and stuff. If there was a need for volunteers and you would just send the request over, you could send it to me, you could send it to my boss, you could send it, in an emergency, of course, you would send it through the ESF 8 desk, and then they would send it to me. There's a difference between having the Medical Reserve Corps and the Battleborn Medical Corps, because with the Battleborn Medical Corps, what we found out in the pandemic is that they take whatever information you send, and they just send it out to all the volunteers and have the volunteers call you. So you don't get the middleman that's me, or middlewoman, I guess. But yeah, that's what we found in the pandemic, was that if you use like a Battleborn Medical Corps, then you really need to have a contact at your place that's gonna do all that. Whereas with me, you just are gonna need to tell me where they need to report to, but I'll do the scheduling. You tell me what the schedule is, I'll do the scheduling, and I'll get people, and I'll send you a list of names of who's coming, instead of you having to talk directly to the volunteers and figure out if you can use them or not.
Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
All right, and last presentation, we are gonna have Carmen, also from the Health District, talk about the Community Health Needs Assessment. We're running a little short on time, so
I can make it quick.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carmen Hood. I am a health educator here at SNHD. I currently work in the Office of Disease Surveillance, and I'm also the Community Health Assessment and Community Health Improvement Plan Coordinator. So, get my slideshow going. It is that time of day for a second coffee. But yeah, I'm super excited here to present to you guys a Community Health Needs Assessment Hospital proposal. So we'll be getting into depth with that. All right, so to start off, I just want to share my overview of the agenda with what I'll be going over with. So I wanted to go over with what's the Community Health Needs Assessment, our purpose, vision, and goals of this proposal, the partnership process, the benefits to you guys, our 2025 roadmap, our hospital partners, and that you should become a Chimnall champion. So throughout this presentation, I'll be saying Chimnall for our Community Health Needs Assessment. All right, so I just want to start off with this, quote from Helen Keller. So I wanted to just state that partnership and collaboration in the community are key and very important. So this quote from Helen Keller: alone, we can do so little, and together we can do so much. So I wanted to just paint an overall picture for you all, putting in a perspective on why hospital collaboration in the needs assessment is important, and the alignment of our efforts and addressing those priority issues in the community will be beneficial. So you guys all know the phrase, work smarter, not harder. So that's our main goal of this partnership. So this idea actually came up because I reached out to our neighboring county in Maricopa. They have very comparable rates and data. So this was actually, it's not a new idea, but I got this idea from them. So they actually have a local health department hospital collaboration effort right now. They call it the Synapse. And it's a hospital and healthcare partnership that's a collaboration to collect data that informs investment into the needs of the community by completing H&M. So this partnership will definitely help with identifying community needs, assets, resources, and strategies. So this will ensure that we are aiming towards better health as well as health equity for Southern Nevada residents. All right, so to get into the health needs assessment, so an overview of what this is. So just some background information. It's a systematic process that involves the community to identify and analyze those community health needs, so our priority areas and what we want to work on. It's important because it will show hospitals that we need to support these target populations and patient health. So we can also utilize this community health needs assessment by identifying needs and gaps. So My knowledge, nonprofit hospitals are required to complete this every 3 years for the Affordable Care Act requirement, but you guys would like to buy in and buy into this proposal because it will be beneficial to the community needs as well as align priorities with the local health department, SNHD. So this partnership is definitely an investment as it provides opportunities as well as potential grants in the future, expansion of practice, even might be cost effective and cost efficient and time saving. If you guys are collecting data, we are as well. So there is that. So we really need this collaboration and partnership to happen because it will definitely help us work together in reaching our optimal health and the best quality of life for all. So being beneficial to the community and being on the same page. And this is definitely a direction that we are looking at for the future. So this definitely consists of identifying needs, assets, resources, and strategies that we may collaboratively work on for Southern Nevada residents. All right, so this is going to be the overall Chinook Champion process. So what exactly will you guys be involved in? So this will be a 3-year working agreement. So it's not too complicated, but this is an overall visual. So I wanted to state that hospitals will be involved and engaged by the process by collaborating and development of surveys as well as focus group questions and collection of data during the whole CHOP process. Definitely you will be an aid in aiming for specific target populations that maybe we may not have reached yet, and definitely just following along with us on the whole needs assessment process. So we'll collaboratively develop a report that focuses on prioritized needs in the community, and we'll be working on collaborating on our strategic plan as well as our anticipated outcomes, and it will be a 3-year contract. So here's more of the working agreement details. One of the main things I want to highlight would be a financial contribution to help us to help support our data collection. At the moment, we're asking for a 1-hour a week time commitment in the beginning of the process. It'll most likely change and be updated along with our monthly meetings as well. We would like at least one agency representative, at least at the meetings in attendance to make sure that we are upkept with the communication and everyone's on the same page. But I will make sure that you guys are kept up to date, and then this is what we want to build. So if you guys are interested, please reach out to me if you want to learn more. I have way more details, but here are some of the main benefits that are highlighted. So the main ones here is the elimination of duplication of efforts in the community, also helping each other identify those opportunities for joint efforts and building those stronger relationships. And we also have a benefit of creating a more effective and sustainable community health needs assessment. So the overall process will improve as well as just addressing the overall community's most critical health needs as one whole unit. Well, wait, there's more. So we also have additional benefits, just for example, leveraging comprehensive data sources, for example. So these are just a few that we can utilize to collect that input. And then, so for our main goals here, primary goals, we're very flexible, and it's we can modify these goals depending on hospital agencies that are interested in this partnership. But we really want to focus on availability, ensuring those reports like this are available to the public. Wanted to make sure community is our primary goal to increase that participation as well as engagement for data collection and many priority populations that hospitals focus on that we would also like to engage, and lastly, increase the collaboration and outreach to those populations that we can all reach together. So this is our 2025 roadmap. So this is a very high level glance at what the timeline may look like for the upcoming cycle. So we have our anticipated publication of the upcoming one in March 2025. So we are currently on schedule. And this is currently the timeline with one of our hospital partners that we are currently partnered with. And that hospital that we are partnered with is Dignity Health. Dignity Health has been our committed partner for the past two cycles already. So they've been here for the 2019 one, and then our most recent one that was just published in 2021. So we definitely increase our partnership with them and collaboration, as well as engagement with their Dignity Health workers in all different sectors throughout their organization. And we are now on the same page with our alignment and our community priorities. And if I wanted to bring someone in for a testimonial, but maybe another time. And then, so this website here, healthysouthernnevada.org, is where you can find all our reports. So all our previous reports are on there, our current ones. And then this is where we'll have our updates, our progress, and tracking, where it'll be made. So that's another benefit, that it will be full access and availability for you all. So to conclude my presentation, I know there's a lot of information that I did not reach, but the main purpose that I want you guys to at least walk out this room today with is that we really want to increase the amount of hospital facilities as contributing partners in our process, as well as expand our engagement and collaboration in assessing our community's health needs. So we're asking for additional resources, so for example, human and financial, to support our community health group to put CHINAZ together. And we can all have same alignments of priorities in the community. So if we all work together and not duplicate our efforts, we can definitely get more done and have a greater impact in Southern Nevada. So yeah, I just hope you guys will consider becoming a CHINAZ champion today, and just wanted to thank you all for your time. If you guys have any questions, or if we have time, I don't know. But thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carmen. Any questions?
Just a quick question, Chair. Carmen, is the community health report assessment every 2 years? I saw the dates up there, but your requirement, obviously with the pandemic, we probably went on a little hiatus there, but
yeah.
What's the goal with the group?
3 years.
3 years,
yes.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And love your enthusiasm about the project. You did a great job.
I love this project.
And so, for the past 3 years, both assessments were done with the Dignity Health System?
Yes. Okay. So they've been our partners since our first one has been released.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Any questions on the line?
No public comment, ma'am. No questions. Okay. Excuse me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. And then I have business cards. If you guys wanted to reach out to me, I have my contact information there. But thank you all so much for your time today.
We'll also share your presentation with everyone.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, next we are going to have our community health report by Dr. Michael Johnson.
Hi, in the spirit of limited time, I don't really have anything pressing today, so.
Okay. Sounds good. For facility advisory board reports, we have two. The first, Dr. Le Guin had requested that we invite Chris Loftus, CEO of Desert Springs and West Henderson Hospital, just to come and open discussion about the closure of Desert Springs, anything that impacts that you've seen, anything that you need from this committee or the community, and anything else you may want to share.
No, again, thanks for the invite. Again, I'm Chris Loftus. Just a quick summary. We've worked in very strong collaboration with the state of Nevada since about the middle of 2022, explaining to them what our intentions were and wanting to be working full collaboration with them. We announced our intentions to kind of transition the facility, and in doing so, made an announcement to our staff to make sure that they had plenty of time to relocate to either our other sister facilities or any other facilities within the Southern Nevada area. Of about 1,000 employees, we've retained about 700 of them within the Valley Health System and others within other Las Vegas hospitals. As of February 15th, we began starting to limit inpatient operations. And as of March 4th, we had our last inpatient discharge from the facility. Right now, our emergency department is operating essentially as a freestanding emergency department. Our goal with the state of Nevada is to transition from an acute care license to a freestanding emergency department that will operate under the license of Valley Hospital. And in doing that, we'll work with the state. Our goal is to build a brand new freestanding emergency department right across the street from our main entrance at the facility and our employee parking lot. And that will create more efficiency and kind of a newer format and layout for the staff as opposed to a larger emergency department. And also have an emergency department entrance right off of one of the key areas of Flamingo and Bruce. And then we're working, we have a couple of years now, we're just trying to assess what we'll do with the building in terms of utilizing other resources in it or otherwise. So right now we're seeing still very good volume, about 66 visits per day, about 9 EMS rigs a day. And I've had no concerns from any of our other sister facilities. Was very collaborative and reached out to several of my counterparts, even outside the Valley Health System, to let them know when this would be happening and to certainly communicate with me if anything did look out of the ordinary so that we could make sure we're taking care of the area. But our intentions are, again, to continue to serve that area of the community with emergency services. And we're dedicated to that area's strong reputation in that area and a long-lasting relationship with those community members, so we want to continue to serve them. Happy to answer any questions. That was a quick summary.
I do have a question in regards to this. In regards to the EMS and Mr. Hands here, does that look any different? Obviously, not having inpatient beds to support an emergency department does limit that capability, and as you know, that's our region, our area is very tight already. So is there any thoughts of, because of lack of acute care services in that area, and having the backup of inpatient beds, are we gonna relook at perhaps redistricting, looking at the whole area? Because obviously taking that area offline in the central region for the highest level of care, both with Sunrise and UMC, puts us in a bind. So again, I'd like to have these discussions more openly and more notice in the future, but any look from an EMS standpoint on that, because we are feeling it. I know Valley Hospital is feeling it. I know in particular Todd at Sunrise is feeling it. So again, I'm glad we have this agendized and hoping talking about it openly, but certainly during the entire year, we're going to feel this impact because this population is not going to, Henderson is going to stay in that area, in and around, particularly Sunrise, and I'm speaking up on behalf of them, but you know, Valley and UMC obviously are on the periphery of that region, but I don't know if you had any thoughts about that, Mr. Hammond.
Yeah, we've already been in contact with Denial of the state in regards to removing them from the internal disaster rotation process as they transition to an off-site ED status there. That occurred about the same time as about February 15th, I think. I'll have to check again, but that's about the time that it happened. I did run numbers as transport and distribution of those patients over a period of time from the 15th of February to the end of last month. They saw a reduction of about 3,000 patients via ambulance, and a majority of those, about half of those, went to Sunrise Hospital. The other, Whittinger Mountain was distributed to UMC and Valley. Excuse me, in Spring Valley for some reason. Everybody likes Spring Valley. I think that one of the things that's interesting though is that in the same time period year over year, we're actually lower this year than last year for the entire system during that time. So as we move forward, I think we just need to continue to monitor and see what kind of redistribution and ideas we can come up with for those patients that are truly acutely in this place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you're always out of watchful eye on that, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, hi, this is Todd Scottberg.
Hi, Todd.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd just like to take a moment to comment. You know, as was referenced, Sunrise is seeing an increase in EMS activity. It is about half, at least of our understanding of what Desert had previously seen. While challenging, we have been able to accommodate the volume and meet the needs of the community. I think of concern, we just need to start thinking about next winter and other significant volume surges and the ability to handle the population.
leadership. It's never easy transitioning and closing a hospital, so appreciate your leadership for that. Any other questions, Dr. LeGuin? I think you're on the line. Any questions that you had?
No, I don't have any further question. I don't know if John Hammond, John, do you have any additional comment?
I'm sorry, Dr. LeGuin. I have nothing else.
All right. Well, with that, we will move to our next agenda item, which is the sexual assault assessment nurse exam, the SANE program that's currently housed out of UMC. And Mason is going to talk about some challenges with that and the need to expand that.
No, and I, in the interest of time, I'll try to make it abbreviated, but as we all know, the city continues to grow. And as the city continues to grow, unfortunately, we've seen increased sexual assaults and strangulations in particular. And that's comes from a variety of things, both on the adult side and the pediatric side. Also, something that we need to continue to work on is the amount of human trafficking that happens in the Las Vegas community. And unfortunately, we were at the top of the list on that as well. I was listening to the roll call on how many facilities we have in the community and the exponential increase of freestanding emergency departments. We only have one hospital in the entire valley in Clark County that actually handles sexual assaults. So just wanted to have a conversation about, we see about 150 patients a month at UMC. We receive about 200 transfers in. Obviously, these are very complex cases, but lots of forensics around it, lots of time, lots of supplies, lots of intervention with the authorities. So again, I'll keep it brief, but we are seeking more community engagement, more facility engagement, often too, in the cases that I've looked at and get involved in, there's also a mental health component around it. And that's kind of compounding to our behavioral health, mental health issues out of the streets. We have large events, we see an increase of these type of patients. With that, Madam Chair, I just wanted to mention that UMC will be looking for more engagement over the next year to be able to help with this crisis, unfortunately. We don't get any extra funding. We often are doing this within our facility, and it ties up our spaces a lot. So, looking for more assistance in the sexual assault area from the other hospitals. So I'll leave it at that, but I do want to have that as an emerging issue that, you know, most communities, pretty much every community, hospitals engage in this type of thing. And it's just not unique to one hospital. So that's it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Mason. I think maybe at our next meeting we can engage Metro to come and someone from the same program. To talk, not just look, I think the bigger thing, right, to talk about what it would mean for the hospitals to.
And I think the big thing too is, you know, putting patients in ambulances and creating more additional delays and trauma and experience that we should be able to handle this in every emergency department in the valley. So we just, I don't think we need it in everyone, but we look at where a lot of this population is coming into and being treated initially would be very helpful.
Do you have the numbers of where they're coming from?
We get about 200 transfers in to us a month, and then we've got our own patients that come in through our own doors via Metro.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is a real critical discussion. Mason, thank you for framing it, because this is an issue that, unfortunately, I think it's going to continue to grow. You know, as you pointed out, the expertise, and I think it's a great suggestion to have Metro come just to explain what they're looking for institutions that can provide the service in order to protect the integrity of the exam and to ensure the integrity as the cases go through the judicial process. So it encouraged that dialogue. I understand the challenges, particularly being all centralized in one entity. But I think we also understand there are significant barriers that would need to be overcome in training and staffing in order to ensure competency, you know, across across, you know, other hospitals and not to jeopardize, you know, the judicial process if there is a, you know, a violator and going through the process, not doing the exams the proper way, et cetera. I'll pause. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Todd. And we had actually, Jack had spoken a little bit to Metro prior to this, and it does seem like on their end they have a desire to expand as well. Like you mentioned, and like Mason has mentioned too, that the training for this is very extensive. I think upwards of 20 to 30 hours per caregiver. And so I think if we can invite someone from the same program to come share that, and then Metro at our next one, we can have a more in-depth conversation on that. Does that sound good?
Thank you.
Yeah, and maybe there could be some dialogue, you know, if there are any grant or extramural funding, you know, either nationally or on the state level, to help support these initiatives, because no matter who expands, you know, given, and I can speak from experience when we had a same program in the past, it is a heavy lift to get folks trained, the competency, having folks 24 hours around the corner, having all of the necessary equipment, cameras, evidence kits, handoff of evidence kits. It's both a significant capital investment and human resource investment as well. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Johnson, would you or someone on your team be able to look at any types of grant funding out there with the state for this before our next meeting?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Just made a note to do
okay.
that.
Perfect. That'll
I think the Office of Victims and Crimes is always a good lead for the state, because that's typically where all hospitals look for these type of cases, but also any type of assault and other things. But you know, certainly, as Todd mentioned, there's a lot of coordination, and we've all heard about kits in the past and the controversy around that, and so there's certainly we certainly would like to bring in the prosecutors too from the DA's office. So I think it's, like I said, this is not a solution overnight. I think it's going to take a good year, but we got to start working towards it, because again, the volume is increasing, human trafficking increasing, and again, often, and Dr. Young is a great ER doctor. I know he sees this coming in the emergency room as well. So, you know, just the sensitivity around that. And these things aren't your typical 45-minute, an hour visit. Patients are there for 8 to 12 hours. So, a lot of things can go right. A lot of things can go very wrong, as Todd mentioned. So, he speaks from experience.
I've also had the experience of having to testify along with the testators, and that expertise is invaluable as well.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of that as well.
That's great to bring it up, because it's just not that one visit, it goes on. So, and again, when you talk about pediatric forensics, I mean, we're that's a very unique specialty. We've got one at UMC, but we often rely on the University of Utah for that expertise and the testimony and that type of thing. So.
Well, Jax and I will work offline with this with Dr. Johnson so that we can have a more in-depth discussion at our next meeting and bring in Metro, same program, and anyone else that Deborah Fox from your team will suggest. All right, with that, we're going to have our second public comment. Again, comments are limited 5 minutes per speaker. If anyone would like to come up for public comment, the microphone is open. Any public comment on the line?
No, ma'am, no public comment.
All right, well, with that, I'm gonna motion to adjourn, and we will see. Do we have a deed for the next one?
At the call of the chair.
Call of the chair. So I know it used to be quarterly, and then it got moved
to semi-annually.
Yes, ma'am. Is there, our goal is to make these much more robust and have, you know, active conversations. And so if there's comments or conversations and topics you'd like to discuss, please email myself or Todd or Jax, and we can get those on the agenda. But do we want to keep this semi-annually or to go back to quarterly?
Since you asked, I'd like to go back to quarterly. I don't think we can get momentum and cohesion. And again, thank you for making it much more robust. As chair, I always tried to make that very robust and did a lot of pre-planning, and it's
it's not easy pulling all this together and all the presentations, so thank you to all the ladies that spoke today. But I'd make a suggestion to go back to quarterly. It's an hour, well, an hour 20 out of, and I know you're trying to hit that 4 o'clock time frame, but it's an hour out of our
good discussion.
Yeah.
I would support that as well. I think just given the whole discussion on the state programs and the follow up there, it's a quarterly discussion.
Yes, I will run that and put in a motion. I would like to make a motion.
So it wasn't agendized as a motion, so why don't we call the call the chair for today?
Okay.
And then at the next meeting, we'll have it agendized and the board can motion and vote as it sees fit.
Okay.
Does that work?
We'll schedule the next one in a quarterly fashion.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, council. That's always the
yes, thank you.
Keeping us, make sure we don't violate any public meeting laws.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I'll just bring it for you every time. I was like, I need to make sure I'm prepared.
Right.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.